Okay, Europeana, which is the European Union's digital library. And it's interesting, actually, with even though these fall together alphabetically, they also fall together really well conceptually. And some of what the Digital Public Library is actually doing is based on what Europeana has already done. So what is it? It's the gateway to digital resources, and it's very specific. This is not just a library-centric project. It's Europe's museums, libraries, archives, and audiovisual collections. So it's a little bit broader in many ways. Because of Europe's complex national and linguistic composition, it's not at all surprising that it's multilingual. And definitely, it's really based around Europe's cultural heritage. And they see themselves as a trusted source for connecting users to authentic and curated resources. So again, it's not just like the open web. It's really vetted resources, which I think is really important. And that's obviously one of the things that the Digital Public Library of America is thinking about. So their purpose and legal status. You'll see a little bit here with it's both the cultural and scientific heritage, but it's using a cross-domain portal. We'll come back to that in a minute. They're using it as a way to facilitate formal agreements between libraries, museums, and archives. So it's not we're just going to go out and we're going to scrape your content whether you want us to or not. It's all based on formal legal agreements. They also see this as actually broadening the digital content that's available in Europe. So it's not just we're going to gather together what people already have, but they see it as a way of providing infrastructure to encourage sort of mass digitization. And the Europeana project was originally conceived as a sort of, in some sense, a counterculture response to Google Books. Now, Google said they were going to sort of digitize the world, and they based it all a lot off of American universities, and the Europeans said, "Well, that's not us." And so, to some extent, the Europeana is sort of saying we're going to do something different. And legally, they are headquartered in the Netherlands, with the excuse me, yes, with the Netherlands. And the Dutch National Library. They describe themselves sort of from four unique perspectives. And when you look at their website, this is very clear. So, there's a Europeana for users, and they have a very sort of focused goal to provide a single access point for the millions of books, paintings, films, etc., that they have available. It's been extremely popular. When it first came out, the response was so overwhelming they managed to crash the service almost right away. They average around 25 million hits a day, so lots is going on. They see it as providing a way of gathering the cultural heritage institutions together and to provide outreach for their users. So it's not just it's a way for a museum to get its collections in. It's a way for the museum in country one to show what they have in relation to museums in country two or three or four. So it's they see it as a way of broadening people's understanding of the cultural heritage. And I think one of the reasons that they think of it in that way is because there's been so many wars in Europe. Stuff that originally ended up that started out in Hungary very well may have ended up in Paris or in some museum in England. I mean, there's lots of cultural pilfering that's gone over the years. And so where you think something may exist isn't necessarily where it actually is. And so this is a way of sort of bringing all that together in interesting ways. They're definitely seeing it as a way as for creating some infrastructure and some opportunities for professionals in the cultural heritage section. They do a lot of outreach with librarians and curators and archivists, and provide some interesting both job opportunities as well as internships. And because this is centrally funded, they see part of their outreach is sort of like what Linda does with, you know, in terms of public policy, reaching out to the legislators where people are, you know, where the funding is actually coming from. So content. One of the annoying things I found when I was working on this is, you know, it's easy to find, you know, this is a list of the types of content that's there. They don't provide any nice statistics for how many, say, you know, how many images or how many books or how many sound recordings. You know, it's easy to find there have 20 million objects. But from that 20 million objects, what's there? The other interesting thing, and we'll come back to this in a minute, is the no direct downloads. And we'll talk a little bit about why this. So here's some of the figures. 20 million objects from 1,500 institutions from 32 countries. And that gives sort of the top ones. So the model that they're using is a centralized funding and coordination model. Originally, the funding to get them started came from the European Union itself. Now, there is a certain amount of funding that comes from each of the countries that participate, which I think is an interesting amount. It's not coming from the institutions that participate. It's coming from the countries. So, you know, you may have 5 libraries in Great Britain that are contributing, and maybe 50 libraries in France, but it's coming from the central government. They're using a content aggregation model, and this is really what the Digital Public Library of America is doing. One of the things early on they realized there was no way that they could build a centralized repository with digital copies of everything that existed from all these places, with sort of standardized metadata. So the goal was, you know, how do you sort of help find all this stuff, make it presented in a way that people can find it, so people don't necessarily need to know, oh gosh, this is from Oxford, and this is from the Bibliothèque Nationale, and this is from you know, the State Library in Berlin, but it presented it in some sort of a common portal. They use content recruitment through a council of content providers and aggregators, which I thought was really interesting. So it's not like any little place can contribute. There's a content recruitment process. And again, that goes back to the idea of this being a curated collection. And they're very definite in their stance on that. One of the things that they do is, you know, because it's a content aggregation model, you know, what they're aggregating obviously is the metadata. And so they ingest the metadata and they also improve the metadata. So part of what they're trying to do is build some commonality, because obviously what Oxford is doing is probably different from what, you know, a museum in the Netherlands is doing, because they have different needs. So how do you bring those together in some way that you can actually search. The other thing that they're trying to think about is, because their portal that they built is built on the semantic web idea, they're trying to look for ways that they can improve the metadata so that it makes that semantic capabilities of cross-searching a little better. They work with a common portal, but they also have a lot of API, so people can take the data and, you know, build their own application based on either all of the content within DPLA or parts of the content, and we'll see some of that with some of the exhibitions that they've done. So the other thing that they're doing is virtual exhibits, and that's typically done with some sort of API. So their metadata model, you know, works with mixed metadata model. Each user does their own thing. But, you know, they try to use some well-known standards. One of the things that they are currently working on is this European data model and how that works as linked open data, because one of the things that they want to be able to do is publish this metadata as an open data store. So for those of you who understand open data stores, people know what that is? Yes? No? Some people? An open data store basically is an openly available collection of data that you can do something else with. And that's where the APIs come in. So, you have an open data store and you can maybe want to pull, you want to do something on Rembrandt. And there may be 40 museums in Europeana that have Rembrandt stuff. Because you can get to this open data store, you don't have to go and say to all these different museums individually and say, could you give me the metadata just on Rembrandt? You can go to the open data store, write a program that pulls that Rembrandt data, and maybe build a virtual collection around Rembrandt from a variety of these museums. So they want to provide that capability. So for people who want to do interesting stuff that they're not planning on doing, and then that makes that application development much faster because, they have a limited amount of staff. They can only do so much. And once people see all this stuff, they say, oh, gosh, what if I could do X? And they may not want to wait for your piano people to get around to doing some of these extra things. So providing it in an open environment allows other people to take that and do it. Okay, so here's the semantic, uses a semantic search engine, and it's based on this idea of who, what, when, and where. And he talks about what each of those means. You can either do a general search, or you can do a very specific search. So, you can put in the names of actors, authors, or whatever, and it will pick that up from wherever. But you can also say, if you're really specific, I want Shakespeare. You can put who, colon, and Shakespeare's name. So it's saying, this is a person. And so it picks it up on that way. One of the things that we'll see, and we'll look at a couple examples, and this is where the semantic piece is coming in. It's finding stuff, and then at the bottom of the screen, it will show you other related things. So it's really quite interesting. It does support Boolean logic. It does have some interesting filters. So yes, you can filter once you get a search result by media type and see how many books and that sort of thing, but you can't do that up front. You can't say, I only want to look at books and I want this particular topic. You have to do the search, filter afterwards. So then there are ways what they call exploring your piano. So this is one of the things that they do is they do these curated exhibits somewhere. I can't find my mouse. Where are we at? So this is from a curated collection from the Jewish Museum in London. Now, the Jewish Museum in London did this exhibit. They don't necessarily own all of this material. But what they've done is they've written some sort of API, gone out and pulled all of this material together to look at material. So we can talk about, let's do plays maybe. You see they're doing some stuff and showing a variety of things. Then you can click on these objects and actually go back to the original library from which it came. But it's a way of pulling disparate content together. The other one that's interesting, which is done somewhat differently, is this one on World War I. So actually they're doing some, when you look at the Explorer story, so this is a curated collection, but it also gives you the ability to add your own story. So if you have a relative or something, I doubt there's very many, if any, World War vets still around, but obviously there may be some people who were children, that still, you know, so, but you could have relatives that are World War One vets, and you, so you could add your own story. So it's a way of contributing to the larger project, and building community. So that the idea of community is also really quite big. You can look by newest content. You can look by provider. You can look at an interactive timeline, which I thought was a little bit, which was interesting. So I did a search for World War, and so you can see along the bottom, you can see dates here. So 1930, 1940. So you can see by timeline where material exists. And the other thing that they've done, which I don't think is particularly effective yet, but it could be, is on a map. So I did a search for Isaac Newton as a person. So I did the who, and so what it's doing is it's plotting locations on the European map where collections of Isaac Newton exist. So in some sense, you know, if you're wanting to go to libraries or archives and you want to see originals, this would be obviously a really quick way of beginning to track down some of the content. And the bigger the purple circle is, the more content there is. So, you know, in some cases I saw some, you know, some that were really large circles. Sort of obliterates part of the map. But okay. Yes, Europeana is publicly accessible. The other thing that I should have mentioned is the interface is available in all 29 official European languages. And when you get, if you play with the Europeana site, which is just www.europeana.eu, you get to the big public site. But as you begin to explore, you get what's called the professional site. So if you're interested in more advanced stuff about curating the collection or, you know, ways to participate, it sort of shifts you over to another site. One of the things that I didn't do, which maybe we should do here, I'm not going to do this on the map. I just want to, because one of the things, so if I do the who for Isaac Newton again. It does help to spell it correctly, doesn't it? I can spell. I just can't type. Newton. So you'll see all of this, you know, various things where Isaac Newton appears somewhere. You can't tell just until you mouse over it where it's from. So this one here that's highlighted is from Uppsala University. And the reason that you can't download anything directly is because it's an aggregated site. So what it does, so, you know, if you were interested in seeing a copy of this, and if this copy was available to download, what it does is it takes you back to the library that did the digitization, and they may or may not provide the ability to print or download. It's because of that aggregated model, and I think that's what you're probably going to see with the Digital Public Library of America, because the complexities of trying to do a centralized, non-aggregated program is just too overwhelming. And they're spending a lot of money. I mean, even this has been up and running since I think it went public in 2008. It's costing about 20 million euros a year.
How do they get
the government? Well, there are 32 countries participating, so you divide it out probably somewhat based on the amount of content. So it may be, you know, for some of the smaller countries, maybe they're paying $500,000, but a lot, you know, maybe the larger countries are paying $2 million. So it's really not, when you spread it over that many entities, the 20 million euros may not be that insurmountable. But here was a part of the semantic piece. So we found this letter by Isaac Newton. So what they've done in this explore further is they've used the semantic search engine to pull up other letters, in this case letters by Isaac Newton, that may be of interest to you. Okay. Who's next on the... Deb's next on the list, okay?